I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 195 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me with questions and comments at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. We've got a long interview this week, so let's get right to it. One of the lies about vaccination is that there are no significant areas for serious critique. I've covered people who have detailed scientific concerns, as well as the experiences of individuals. But today's guest is looking at the broader issue of marketing of one vaccine, HPV, and how pseudo-feminist language is used to give only the appearance of informed consent to girls, the targets, and their parents, usually the mothers. Genevieve Rail has a PhD from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. She's taught courses related to women's bodies, physical activity, and health at the University of Ottawa's Faculty of Health Sciences from 1991 to 2009. She's now Professor of Feminist Cultural Studies of Health at the Simone de Beauvoir Institute of Concordia University. She's known for her research on women's experiences of body-related institutions, such as health systems, pharmaceutical industries, and the media, and favors feminist post-structuralist post-decolonial and queer approaches. She's written over 100 articles and book chapters and has been a keynote speaker in many Canadian and international conferences. She's been funded by Canadian and Australian research organizations for over 20 years on projects involving women from various sexualities, races, ethnicities, abilities, and socioeconomic milieus. Her current projects focus on fatness, HPV vaccination, breast and gynecological cancer care for LGBTQ persons. Welcome to the show, Genevieve.
Thank you so much, David.
Sorry, it was a longer introduction than I planned. I decided to interview you on the basis of your recent paper in the Canadian Journal of Public Health, which interviewed young women, or girls, I guess depending on their age, their parents, which appeared to be usually the mothers, and health practitioners, about the HPV vaccine. First of all, did the journal give you any pushback on what could be interpreted in some ways as critical of the vaccine? And not entirely, but there are aspects of your paper that could be interpreted that way. Did the journal have a problem with you talking about both
No,
sides?
I think normally with any journal associated with public health, I'd say in the Western world, there would have been some pushback. However, the article will appear because what's currently out is an early online version.
Mm-hmm.
But once it will be out with the rest of the issue, it is a special issue focusing on qualitative research in health, published by the Canadian Journal of Public Health. And for that special issue, there is an editor who's quite partial to qualitative research and to the kind of work that I've been doing. And so I think the pushback has been minimal. I think the reviews that came back were quite severe, but at the same time, I could answer all of the questions, and in the end, the publication decision was go for it, and so I was quite happy.
Yeah.
Although, yes, I expected a bit more pushback than I did get in
yes.
the end.
Yeah, it does seem that recently there's been very little tolerance for dealing with issues like the effectiveness and safety of vaccines. It's all supposed to be a team sport with everybody on the same team.
You're right.
Which doesn't make for a very fun game. So why did you decide to talk to both the users and the givers, or the maybe not the prescribers, but the people who are actually giving the vaccine? Why did you decide to talk to them? And maybe you can explain a little bit about what do you really mean by qualitative research?
Yes, so this project, basically the idea was there's currently a lot of talk in Canada about the HPV vaccine, and at the time we started the study there was even more because it was a bit novel at the mm-hmm. time. And so myself and team members were interested to, we wanted to focus on the kinds of things that are being said about the vaccine. So we use the term discourses,
mm-hmm.
either coming from the pharmaceutical industry, what is it that they were saying about the vaccine,
right.
and then how much of what they were saying was affecting the young girls, And because these young girls are, social subjects, you recognize a sociologist in me, mm-hmm. We knew that these young women would normally be also impacted by the discourses that health professionals have with regards to the vaccine, or maybe their parents have with regards to the vaccine, maybe some of their classmates, maybe their professors. And so when we started the study, we put the young women at the center, mm-hmm. and then we're trying to identify what are all the discourses around them, and what impact does it have on them? Like, in the end, what do they think about this vaccine, and how is it impacting the way that they think about their bodies, the way that they think about being protected or not, or being at risk or not, and so on. So it was a fairly naive question, and we really did not have an idea of, I mean, we knew the kinds of discourses that were starting to circulate around the HPV vaccine, but we really did not know how young women, like, what they make out of it.
When people think of asking questions, like, generally these days, it's very structured. You know, how was your experience with Air Canada? Good, very good, bad, right?
Yes.
So was your interview kind of structured into specific questions, or were you basically asking a broad question and then trying to analyze what you got back?
The latter, because we submitted this proposal to the Canadian Institute of Health Research and presented it as a qualitative research. So we were really going fishing a little bit in the sense that we this was not an inquiry where you had multiple choices of answers and we would just ask subjects to answer these, A, B, C, and so on. We were really interested in having a chat with these young women, but also their parents, the health professionals, to go more in depth, and the advantage being a more in-depth understanding of what they think about the vaccine, the disadvantage of all of this being, of course, that because it's a qualitative study, we cannot interview 5 zillion people. We have to have a fairly small sample, so we go more in depth with a smaller number of people. So this was the design that we proposed, and we thought out of the answers that we get, perhaps it's going to guide us towards other studies where maybe we could go more for a quantitative type of survey. So this was really a thought of as a first step.
I mean, this that kind of approach, you could identify new issues because you're not sort of narrowing people down. I find that with a lot of surveys is I feel like I'm being pushed into a certain questions, certain opinions, and I might have a different take on it, but that's not the ABC answer. But one of the things you commented was that a lot of the young women, I don't know if apathetic is the right word, but they didn't have a lot of knowledge and they were seeming to leave the decision to their parents or to put their trust in school officials or medical officials.
Yes, and I think for us this result was devastating because you would want a new vaccine about an issue like this one to start a conversation with young women about sexuality, about safe sex practices, about the circulation of viruses and whatnot. And our results were basically, in all the provinces, it was the same, that young women, and we also interviewed a few young men, we're basically in classes where the issue was not discussed with them by their teachers, often probably because there's no sexual education, as is the case in Quebec, for instance, but also in some other provinces. And so the issue was not discussed. The students were basically given forms that they had to bring to their parents, and their parents were supposed to sign or not whether they agreed to the vaccination of their children. And so in the mind of these young women, the decision was their parents to make and not theirs. And they felt that the way that it had been presented was so matter of fact, because usually they combine this vaccination operation at the same time as when they vaccinate for when they provide other kinds of vaccines. And so it was presented as, well, this is just one of them. And so the way that it was presented to them, as well as to their parents, they did not understand the harms and benefits. They did not understand exactly what it was. We had funny answers where some young girls in Quebec, for instance, mistook the papilloma virus with papillon, which is a butterfly. Cervical cancer in French is... has a word that sounds like col de l'utérus, but col is very similar to colon, so some thought that it was a virus attacking their colon. Mm-hmm. And so it was quite evident to us with the answers provided by these young women that they knew generally not a whole lot about the vaccine, about what it could do or not do to them, about what were some of the implications in terms of adverse reactions. And basically the results say exactly the same for the parents. The parents were, some of them, a bit more informed, but in general, very little information, very little knowledge. And the pamphlet provided to them to inform them, again, not a whole lot of information that could make a difference between accepting or not to have their children vaccinated.
Would you say that the pamphlets are designed to provide balanced information or to drive people towards acceptance of the vaccine?
The latter, and in and our other article that we published, we used the term manufacturing consent, using a term that's
Noam
quite
Chomsky.
Familiar with Noam Chomsky.
Yeah.
And really, the way the pamphlets are designed is to say that there's a crisis situation, there's an epidemic of cervical cancer, which is, of course, not the case. We thought the marketing was fraudulent, and we wrote that in the article, but presenting as a crisis situation, and parents can do something about it by saving their girl from cancer by having the daughter vaccinated with the HPV vaccine.
I think you asked that question, do you want to save your daughter from cancer? You're going to get one answer from all but the most egregious of parents.
Of course.
But there was a minority of mothers and maybe a very few girls and even some health practitioners who did have concerns about the vaccine. And what were those concerns?
Yes.
Or some of them?
So some of the parents did complain about the lack of information.
Mm-hmm.
Some went to the internet to try to find information, and it's very hard to find good quality information about the vaccine, because what we get is pieces of information that are basically parroting what the manufacturing companies are saying about these vaccines, which we show in other studies that are not reliable, and which I think if you want to talk about it a bit later, but the whole Cochrane collaboration explosion at the moment is partly about. So these parents were not happy that they felt that the consent that they were giving for the vaccine, because they were afraid of what their daughter might catch in terms of a virus, that it was a consent that was not sufficiently informed. So they did complain about the lack of information.
Mm-hmm.
And then some parents, and this was a spurious finding, in other words, we, after the first year of studying, our main finding was nobody knows what this vaccine is all about. Nobody knows the harms and benefits. It's terrible. Ethically speaking, we have a manufacturing of consent, and it's blah, blah, blah. But after about a year of interviews and whatnot, we stumbled upon people who responded to the ads that we had put a bit everywhere in public places in different provinces. mothers of young women who purport to have been injured by the vaccine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so these mothers were telling us that, you know, they knew of so many other mothers who'd had the same problem. Their main complaints were that, of course, if they go to the doctor and say, I think my daughter has been injured by the vaccine because
right.
time-wise, this occurred right after the vaccine and my child has always been happy and healthy. And now
right.
after the vaccine, she's in a wheelchair and has this and this problem or has died, because we had one woman who said that her daughter had died following
right.
the HPV vaccine. And so suddenly we, and I think because our research design, because it's hard to get parents to want to talk about something they don't know a whole lot about,
mm-hmm.
we ask at the end of each interview, are there other mothers that you know that would be interested in a study like ours and who would feel
right.
Okay to be talking to us? And
right.
they would provide sometimes names. And in the case of these mothers, they provided names of other mothers who had
mm-hmm.
injured daughters.
Mm-hmm.
And so we ended up having a sizable amount just because of the way our methods was, who talked to us about not being able to convince the doctors or to have the doctors listen to them when they were talking about a link between perhaps the vaccine
mm-hmm.
and what's happening with their daughter. Some doctors threatening to not to continue being their family doctor
mm-hmm.
if they continue with the vaccine story. Doctors refusing to report, and because in Canada we have a vigilance program for vaccines.
Adverse event monitoring.
Yes. Yes.
Program. Yeah.
And so actually there's a number of them. There's a separate one in Quebec. There's a Canadian one and so on.
Right.
But normally doctors, if they're asked to report, they should be reporting,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but in the case of the HPV vaccine, all of the people that we've interviewed all had the same answer and complained of the same problem, is the doctors not listening and not wanting to report it in the system. And so...
That's a whole other study. It's like, why would doctors be so reluctant? Are they feeling potentially culpable for maybe having recommended or having given the vaccine, or are they scared of being deregistered as a doctor if they, you know, cause trouble about the vaccine? It'd be interesting to know what the doctors
yeah,
were.
Yeah, I think there would be an interesting study to do there. Because I have lots of friends who are doctors. Some of my old basketball friends in the days when I was a very active university person, and I have friends who are architects and whatnot, but I happen to have a bunch of friends who are
mm-hmm.
in the health profession as health professionals, and you know, so I don't want to accuse them.
Right.
I think the pharmaceutical industry has been very successful in circulating a particular discourse about the vaccine.
Right.
And until you hear some bad stories, there's no reason for you to doubt what the pharmaceutical industry is telling you.
Right.
You know, the way the publication business is all about, and I think, the Cochrane Collaboration Explosion is all about that, is that medical research, as well as academic research, is more and more colonized by the pharmaceutical industry,
yes.
who is funding people, and then it becomes more difficult to say certain things against certain products.
Right.
You know, if the HPV vaccine is like most other products, there's a certain story that gets to be circulated, and
right.
certain things get to be silenced.
Right.
And so to the, how do you say, not the discharge, but you know, so I don't want to be a person thinking that doctors have bad faith.
Mm-hmm.
I think if I trust what I hear around me in the medical circles, some doctors are receiving money from the pharmaceutical industry,
right.
and so these people should know better.
Right.
And I don't think these kinds of corruptive practices should be allowed in Canada or anywhere
right.
else in the world. But apart from these individuals, I think a regular doctor, you know, knows nothing about vaccines in general. They're not trained in vaccines. Even pharmacists are not trained in vaccine science. And so they hear there's this fantastic vaccine that's going to prevent cervical cancer. Why not? And they provide it, and the Canadian government pays for it. And so we have these mass vaccination sessions, and that's that.
Two things you said in the paper about the messages that appear to be sent. You pointed out that 99.7% of Canadian women die of something other than cervical cancer. In other words, cervical cancer in Canada is not even a leading cancer, let alone a leading cause of death. I don't know if you mentioned, I think you did, that in most countries, the rate of cervical cancer has actually been going down prior to any vaccination program.
Yes, in all the countries where there's been prevention programs put into place, which happens to be the case for sort of middle income and high income countries. Mm-hmm. For other countries where money is lacking and healthcare is not as it's at its maximum. Or where there's so many things that are lacking, and where prevention programs are absent, it is true that we have a much higher rate of death from cervical cancer. Mm. However, in these countries, there's so many other things that are more important, diseases that are more prevalent, and so I think in the article I cite the so-called third world countries, 25 other leading causes of death before we get to the cervical cancer. So even in low-income countries, cervical cancer should not be a priority. That's not where we should be putting the money. We should be putting the money where the leading causes of death are and not on the 26th cause of death. Is my way of thinking about it. In Canada and in other richer countries, similarly, we should be in public health, not putting at risk healthy bodies, and rather we should use this money to provide public health policies and practices that are going to benefit the largest amount of people, and that are not putting at risk those who are currently not at risk of dying of cervical cancer.
Right. Did you find that the message that the vaccine will reduce the risk of cervical cancer was a message in most of the health practitioners?
Yes, the association between this vaccine and cancer is the strategy that Merck, the manufacturer, decided to use, and I think it's an important strategy. It was a beautiful strategy for Merck, because the minute that you talk about cancer, then you talk about horrible death and you talk about fear.
Right.
And so a lot of people were quite ready to embark on this whole strategy to say, hey, for the first time in the world's history, we can prevent a cancer, and cancer is so important.
Right.
And so if we can do it, why not? Why would we not do
it?
And so from that perspective, marketing of the HPV vaccine was absolutely beautiful. Merck won all sorts of prizes in medical marketing, and they succeeded. And so at this point, it's a $2 billion a year industry because the marketing has been so successful.
And you pointed out that the vaccine, the two vaccines that are available, are only against certain strains, and those are not the only strains associated with cancer, whether it's causative or not. And secondly, that the protection is only believed to be 5 to 10 years, which would mean that you then, in 5 or 10 years, as an adult woman, you'd have to get vaccinated again and again and again. And of course, the risk of whatever the risk of the vaccine is then becomes multiplied if you have to have it 4 times or 5 times throughout your life. You've multiplied the risk 4 or 5 times.
Definitely. That's part of the rationale for not supporting this vaccine. But I think even before we get there, when we look at the clinical trials that the company put together, the clinical trials were fraudulently done in the sense that the rules of science were not followed. Mm-hmm. False placebos were right. used, and this was done for a reason, and it has to do with camouflaging the adverse reactions, because if you have a substance in the placebo that is the same substance that in the vaccine provides we think a number of the adverse reactions, mm-hmm. then you compare the two, there's the equivalent number of adverse reactions, and bingo, you have a safe vaccine.
Right.
So that's one of the issue. But the even before we talk about this, the clinical trials were terrible for Merck. And when you look at whether the HPV vaccine is good at preventing CIN or cervical intraepithelial neoplasia, basically abnormal cells in
so
the cervix.
So what they might call precancerous lesions or something.
Yes, some use the word precancer,
right.
But it's a stretch because, mm-hmm. again, we're not talking about cancer, we're just talking about abnormal cells, and
mm-hmm.
we all have abnormal cells,
right.
and they come back to normal on their own, and it's not a big issue. So
mm-hmm.
So whether the vaccine was had efficacy for stopping the virus 18 or 16, so they looked at groups of young women who had abnormal cells, and they looked whether in these cells there was HPV 7, 16 or 18,
mm-hmm.
They found that it worked beautifully if the young women in the clinical trials were following the protocol, that is, were having the three injections at the right times and at the right age, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So 98%.
Right.
So bingo. This was it. This was the end of the story for Merck,
right.
and because they thought 98%, we stop 16 and 18 from entering these young women's bodies.
Right.
Perfect. Now, when you continue the story and you look at more, you know, the clinical trials a bit more carefully, then you find that if you look at these young women who have abnormal cells, and you look at those who have not been fully vaccinated, let's say they had only one injection instead
mm-hmm.
of three, or two instead of three, or they had it in a small amount of time as opposed to a larger amount of time, or so they did not follow protocol
right.
correctly, the efficacy goes down to 44%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those who did not follow protocol, we call them intent to treat, and individuals who are in intent to treat, we always use normally these individuals because they're closer to real life individuals.
Right, right.
Because in real life, people don't always follow the protocols.
Yeah, a girl's sick.
A girl is sick,
she
changes school,
right.
she
mm-hmm.
misses one injection, da da da. So right there, the 44% efficacy was much lower than what they would have liked to see.
And this
now,
was at preventing, like,
this was at preventing CIN. The entrance of 16
or
and 18.
Right, not preventing cancer, because that's impossible
no.
to measure.
And then they did something interesting. They in the same clinical trial, they looked at the possibility of preventing, again, these abnormal cells. But this time, abnormal cells that would have maybe prevented the entrance of 16 and 18, but would have maybe not prevented the entrance of other kinds of HPV
mm-hmm.
viruses. And there, they found that there was zero efficacy.
Right.
Actually, they did not, even with a FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, and requesting through journalists that they would share their protocols. They did not, and they provided just the in intent to treat, so those who did not follow exactly the protocol, and they basically found out that there was no statistical significant difference between the placebo group and the real group, and so that means there's zero efficacy.
And you're talking about the even, other strains? Or?
So basically, the hypothesis mm-hmm. is that we're currently having a giant experiment.
Right.
All over the world, we may be protecting girls in the sense of preventing HPV 16 and 18 to come
right.
in their bodies. But in French, we say, quand les chats sont partis, les souris dansent. When the cat is out of the room, the mice are dancing.
Right.
And basically, is that we suspect that other HPV strain, because there's over 200 of them,
right.
are now saying, okay, so 16 and 18 are not causing the cancer. So maybe we could do that.
Right.
And they replace, so they call that viral replacement. They
okay.
come to play the role of 16 and 18, and they come to, and so this was the reason, the chief reason why we wanted to vaccinate young girls, because we figured that those who were already infected with the HPV virus and were given the vaccine were more likely to get cancer than others. So that was the main reason. But basically, so there's lack of efficacy from the get-go.
Right.
Yet Merck was able to convince the FDA to still market this product.
That doesn't really surprise me. I think that's sort of the history of the FDA. Tomorrow I'll be in Ottawa talking about a drug called mefloquine and a sister drug. Mefloquine has a lot of problems, an antimalarial drug, and the sister drug was just approved by the FDA. You know, something like 15 out of 16 commissioners approved it, but there were people at the meeting saying it has all of these same problems that mefloquine have, like causing psychotic behavior, which is kind of a big one. But despite that, it seems much more important to do what the pharmaceutical company wants in terms of getting new drugs on the market. And there actually was a new advertisement I heard in the United States about how brave and wonderful all the researchers are who are creating all these new drugs. It was sponsored by Pharma, the pharmaceutical lobbying group. But they were portraying these people as, you know, in the laboratory, following all these dead ends, rejecting things that don't work, and then every once in a while coming up with a brilliant new addition to the pharmacopoeia. Anyway, that seemed...
And that's, unfortunately, that's pretty much the way that things work. And again, I have lots of colleagues who do research in the health sector and in the pharmaceutical sector, and some of them are, you know, they're good people. I mean, they're just doing their work and they're doing but the problem is that once they come up with certain results, then the pharmaceutical industry is rich enough to pay for firms to use these numbers and these statistics and to twist them in a way that's going to make the product look really good and is going to, you know, end up convincing Health Canada or the FDA to market these products, which are not necessarily very good and sometimes are dangerous. And, you know, a researcher like Marc-André Gagnon, for instance, has found that for some products, the inundation of the market by these companies that are subcontracted to write medical articles, you could have like one positive study in a multi-center where there's four other centers where the four others are not finding positive result. Well, you can use that result from that fifth center that is positive, give it to a firm, and they'll inundate the market with something like 1,200 articles, you know, saying how wonderful this product is, and bingo, you've got it made. And so it's a bit of a travesty because
yes.
there's some good research being done, and then there's, you know, some, you know, for me, this tale of the HPV is a tale not unlike others. It's a tale mostly of money,
right?
Of marketing, and of academic and academic research and medical research colonization by the pharmaceutical industry.
Right. Moving on to the issue of feminism.
Yes.
So, how was that used in the marketing program?
Yes, and so I was, as a feminist, obviously I was very much interested to in the main discourses, especially in 2006 when in Canada we started advertising mm-hmm. about this vaccine, and the way things were presented, making the individuals who were being vaccinated or their parents to be such great feminists because they were affirming their right to health and their mm-hmm. right not to have cancer mm-hmm. and they were affirming their feminist position to have a choice and to be able to act on that choice.
Although it's a faux choice, right?
Of course.
Because you actually can't make... You have the freedom to choose, but you don't have the freedom to not choose without being portrayed as irrational.
Exactly. And so young girls were at the same time portrayed as being at risk and mm-hmm. almost using young girls as being totally without subjectivity and being able to think for themselves or even worth a conversation about sexuality, about cancer, about the HPV virus and so on. It's just, no, they're at risk, but we're going to save them. And so being at the same time portrayed as being at risk, but at the same time portrayed as being the bearers of disease. And totally forgetting that, of course, these viruses are transmitted by everyone, mm-hmm. Regardless of gender, but basically putting the onus on young women to be protected and so that they would be in the long run protecting their male partners. So a little bit of heterosexism in there, a little bit of pseudo-feminism in there,
right.
A lot of gender stereotyping, and of course a vision of feminism that's reduced to a neoliberal way of approaching choice and the purchase of a medical product.
What did you mean? I didn't really know what you meant by neoliberal discourses of risk and self-management.
Yes, because of course in a sort of liberal environment in the old style of liberalism,
right.
where you would have a government that would be there to take care of individuals who are sick, of individuals who need protection. A neoliberal approach is now saying, well, we're going to reduce the state, we're going to reduce healthcare,
right.
we're going to privatize wherever we can, and now the onus is on you, the individual, to take your health into your own hands,
mm-hmm.
to purchase the products that will bring you the health from which you will that you will enjoy in your life. And if there's something going wrong with you, if you're too big or too sick, then it's your own fault.
Right.
And of course, this approach is neoliberal because it totally forgets that health is determined by socioeconomics and class, for instance, is the very first determinant of health in Canada
mm-hmm.
and in most
yes.
Western countries. And so that it's a bit sad because we're basically taking away a lot in terms of health, and instead of having the government being responsible for healthy citizenry, now we have the onus on individuals to do the right things so that they become healthy, which of course, if you're a sociologist and you study this question, is horrendous, because we know that health does not come from individual behavior. It comes from larger structural issues, the first one being class, of course, socioeconomic conditions, the environment, these kinds of larger issues on which individuals cannot act on their own. Like they, you know, we need to have like a larger vision of what health could be, at least in Canada or in the United States for that matter.
And I don't see how people can make a rational choice if they don't have a lot of information. And I mean, not everybody wants to learn all the pros and cons of HPV vaccine and a whole bunch of other products that are being put in front of us as healthcare consumers. We might want to, you know, as you get older, cholesterol drug, tested the statin drugs. Men are supposed to get the PSA, women are supposed to have a mammogram, all of these things.
Exactly.
And in
it's
order
returning
to
make the responsibility in the hands of the individuals, and it's totally a faulty way of thinking about health, and particularly about public health, which in this case is public health.
Maybe it's good to segue to talk about Peter Gottschy. When I interviewed him on mammography a couple of years ago, he had created a pamphlet in which he had put what he thought was accurate information about mammography, and I think most people who read the pamphlet would probably be a lot more skeptical about mammography afterwards than beforehand. But some interesting stuff has happened at his institute called the Cochrane Institute, which is supposed to be the leading evidence-based medicine institution in the world. And we just found out that he's being kicked out of the Cochrane Institute because I think you probably know more about this, but there was a paper that was very pro HPV, and then Gottschy and a couple of others wrote another paper from within the Cochrane Institute criticizing it and saying that it was biased because it didn't include all the research, and that has led the Cochrane Institute to shoot the messenger, I think.
Yeah, you're right. Originally, I mean, when the HPV vaccine was rolled out, we started to see mass reactions and mass adverse reactions to that vaccine. One country that was very involved with this was Denmark. Mm-hmm. And in Denmark, there were some doctors, one in particular, Louise Brint, from Copenhagen, who noticed that there was suddenly all these young women mm-hmm. suffering from different things right after receiving the vaccine. So she wrote case studies, she published them with the World Health Organization. She was actually congratulated by the World Health Organization for her work. And she submitted this to the authorities in her country, and her country asked the European Commission to investigate the situation. The European Commission asked its arm, which is the EMA, the European Medical Association, to look into the matter. But the EMA, instead of doing an independent research and trying to figure out what's going on with these side effects, they basically wrote a list of questions that they sent to the manufacturers. The manufacturers told them, no, we have this and this and this study and this and this and this data set that said everything is fine. And so the EMA came out to say, no, the HPV vaccine is fine. And on that basis, the World Health Organization issued a statement to say that the HPV vaccine, after the independent study done by the EMA, was found to be just perfect. So Peter...
Based on pharmaceutical information.
So Peter Gottschy then complained to the European Commission about the EMA's actions mm-hmm. and how their review of the issue was not serious and was mm-hmm. flawed. And so there were a number of other things that occurred, but basically not long after that, Peter Gottschy and some of his colleagues, Jefferson and Jorgensen, published a paper in the British Medical Journal mm-hmm. where and not long after that, the Cochrane Collaboration is a world entity. It has 53 different committees that are set to review in a particular sector.
Right.
In the gynecological and orphan cancer sector, they ask for a review to be made. And that review was made, and it was also problematic, and lots of people involved there had conflicts of interest mm-hmm. with the manufacturer. And so Peter and his colleague published something in the BMG evidence-based mm-hmm. medicine to the effect that this Cochrane collaboration review was problematic.
Right.
And that, and they had also, previously complained about the EMA mm-hmm. and whatnot. And so I think the leaders of the Cochrane collaboration were not really happy with one Cochrane group, the Nordic Cochrane, which Peter Goethe right. is directing, versus the people responsible for the review in gynecological and orphan cancer group, which is also a Cochrane mm-hmm. smaller group, so that those two would be butting heads. They felt it was just not good for the reputation of the and, you know, the Cochrane collaboration as a whole. And I think Peter's book, which he published a few years ago, where he called the pharmaceutical strong. Industry that they were like the mafia and a criminal organization, which I totally agree with. But I think, so there were a number of things, and I think the cherry that hit the cake was, him complaining to the EMA, to the European Commission about the EMA. Anyway, so it's a long story. There's also some right. ramification, but basically, so he was expelled from membership in the executive of the Cochrane Collaboration.
And isn't he one of the founders? Of
he is a co-founder, in 1993.
And, I mean, the Cochrane Institute has published papers that are critical of modern medical interventions, like the flu vaccine,
yes.
in the past. But I know that Gotchi has said that that conflicts of interest are starting to creep in, and that the institution seems to be more concerned about its reputation and doesn't seem to care if some of the people are actually on the payroll of pharmaceutical companies, which is directly contrary to what I understood the organization was supposed to. Supposed to be.
Yeah, I think that the Cochrane Collaboration, some of the ideas are not bad. I've always been skeptical. I've written critical articles 15 years ago about this. And then when the first review about the HPV vaccine was about to be made, we wrote to the Cochrane Collaboration, myself, Catherine Riva, Jean-Pierre Spinoza, a bunch of people from different countries, to say that there were problems with the protocol that they were trying to use to assess the adverse reactions to the HPV vaccine and the efficacy of the HPV vaccine. This was published on the Cochrane website. So we sent the first letter in 2012. We sent a second letter in 2014. We sent a third letter just recently, and it will be published in the BMG probably in early October. But we've always been quite critical of the way that this particular, because the Cochrane Collaboration has done some fantastic work. Mm-hmm. And I think Peter Goetsch's main point is that the fact that rules have changed mm-hmm. and that the Cochrane Collaboration is starting to listen a bit too much to the pharmaceutical industry. Recently, it received half a million euros from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which is very right. involved in vaccines.
Yeah.
And so it brings the organization to be a bit more tiptoeing around the issue of vaccine because of some of the people who are putting money in right. there to do some of the reviews and to be partner with the larger organization. And so I think Peter has a good point that the Cochrane Collaboration needs to dissolve totally its board of governors or mm-hmm. its executive board to restart and to decide, are we going to be taking money from the industry or are we going to continue with independent evaluation of studies and fighting so that conflicts of interest are always disclosed.
Right.
And that medical journals put their pants up and, you know, start to be not so receptive of papers who are ghostwritten, papers who are written yeah. by other people and that are who are paid by the pharmaceutical industry to make the results look good and so on.
I mean, it seems to me that the Cochrane Institute doesn't add much value if it's just like a lot of other institutes that are taking a lot of money either directly or indirectly from pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah. Well, Peter Goetsch, I think, said it best, and we said this 15 years ago in some of our papers, but The Cochrane collaboration and the Cochrane work has a potential to be fantastic. Mm-hmm. But if we have garbage in, right, then we have garbage out. Yeah. And so the Cochrane, in my sense, should continue with independent evaluation of work that's out there. But I think editors of medical journals have to do a much better job to sift studies, to not accept ghostwritten articles, and to make sure that when reviews are done, that all of the data sets are available and right, can be worked with so that we can come to a right conclusion. Because right, I think that was the case with the HPV vaccine, that only a certain number of data sets were included.
Right, and I think the game that is played is that if you do some research funded partly or completely by pharmaceutical companies and it doesn't come out with a positive result, you just say, that's not interesting, so let's not publish that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that, so you only publish the small studies that have positive results, somebody else comes along and does a meta-analysis, puts together 15 studies that all came up with positive results, and miraculously comes up with a very strong positive result with the meta-analysis.
Yes.
Which is, I call it laundering science, right?
Because yeah,
you're taking something kind of dirty gray and you take out all the white stuff and then you say,
yeah,
it's all good.
And when you think about the HPV situation, is that cervical cancer is not a problem in mm-hmm. Canada. It is not a problem. But now, with the vaccination of young girls, we are creating problem. And I think we should be independently investigating the adverse reactions. There should be some sort of a system put in place, a bit like they've done in the U.S. In the U.S., we're talking about 430 deaths reported so far of young
right,
women. And close to, I think my last number is close to 59,000 young women who've been seriously injured by the vaccine.
Right.
And we think that these numbers are about 1/100 of the reality, because
right,
the reality, the reporting varies between 1-4% of those who are injured who actually go through the trouble of reporting. And so we're talking huge numbers in the U.S.,
right,
probably very important numbers in Canada. Other countries are dealing with problems. You know, we hear about it through newspaper in Colombia, in Japan, and so on. And so I think for the good of young girls and women, we need a true independent research that will establish what is the problem with this vaccine, and
yes,
why do we have a million coincidences of, you know, young girls being vaccinated and the next day they're in a wheelchair. We need to go to investigate this issue, and then we need also to establish need. Is there a need? And
well, you've got some pretty big numbers in the U.S. I don't have the cervical cancer statistics at hand, and obviously not all of those were deaths. There were serious injuries, but the number of cervical cancer cases in the U.S. is not that great. And it seemed like the Pap screening was effective, and who knows, maybe some other government regulations that reduce carcinogens had some unintended benefits. We don't really know. Over time.
But it's interesting that you're talking about carcinogens, because my feeling is that public health business is to deal with health prevention,
mm-hmm.
not this sort of pharmacization or pharmacologization
right.
of health. And because basically what's happened is that since Ronald Reagan established its rule in the U.S. that you cannot sue vaccine companies,
right.
This immunity has allowed the U.S. to produce all sorts of vaccines for all sorts of things with all sorts of adverse events that nobody's interested in, and they're making a killing.
Right.
But the thing is that with vaccine, if that's the way to go for public health, it would mean that now we're talking about shingles, and now reports are starting to start about the adverse reaction to this shingle vaccines.
Right.
We're talking about potential vaccine against breast cancer, And there's about 600 vaccines that are currently in clinical trials around wow. the world. And so if we do find some snazzy company that massages the numbers and establishes that these are all useful, are we going to spend our money to vaccinate people against everything? Like yeah. this to me is a nightmare, and it should not be the direction of public health in Canada or anywhere else in the world. And I think we should focus on the true issues. What are the big diseases and what are the precursors or the causes? And let's try to attack the problem from that angle. That should be the role of public health agencies across right. the world.
I mean, if you look at a lot of causes of death, especially in young people, they're not infectious diseases. Like in the United States, I think every year there's about 30,000 highway deaths and about 30,000 gun deaths. That's a lot of people dying, and it doesn't seem to be anywhere near the public health investigations into those things. I mean, not that people haven't done wonderful things with, you know, making cars and highways safer, but they still obviously have a long way to go. Mm-hmm. In how can we just ignore all those deaths and focus on a cancer? And even if HPV worked, are we going to have 25 different vaccines for lung cancer and prostate cancer and breast cancer and brain cancer? And each of those is going to have adverse effects. So at what point do you discover that more people are dying from your preventions than from what you're trying
question.
To cause?
Yeah.
I'm just looking. We are kind of running out of time, so I'll let you wrap up with some points that we didn't manage to get to on this subject.
Well, we covered a lot of ground, and I'm sorry that it was a bit all over the place, but definitely I'm thankful for the opportunity to talk to you about these issues. But I think for me, the main point is that we do need truly independent research. We need to fight against the colonization of academic research and medical research by the pharmaceutical industry. And I think the health of our young women and older women, and men for that matter, but the health of everyone depends on our public health agencies to remain independent from the pharmaceutical industry, to stop the corruption and the paying of people so that they buy these vaccine and all these other products that are supposed to bring us health, but that are, in my view, useless and where the money is not well spent.
Right.
And I think for feminists, we need to be very careful about the pharmaceutical industry using a pseudo-feminist language to sell us more pharmaceutical products that are unnecessary and that may bring worse health than we have at the moment. And so I think this is a message that needs to be out. And obviously, opportunities like this one for me to speak are rare because, as we said at the beginning of the interview, those who speak against this very powerful aggregate of pharmaceutical corporations, medical institutes, and so forth, and who have the credential, because I'm a sociologist, I'm not a doctor,
mm-hmm.
so... They're very good at silencing the critics, and
right.
I think I'm very thankful that some of the voices are starting to emerge, and these are the voices through my article of young women and their
right.
parents, which I think are important voices for,
mm-hmm,
for
mm-hmm.
Canadians to hear about, and so I think that's something wonderful for me anyways. The publication of this piece is definitely where we should be at, and of course a podcast like this one as well.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your input today. I certainly enjoyed the discussion and learned a lot too.
Great, thank you.
Thank you for listening to episode 195 of The Infectious Myth.